Listener supported. WNYC Studios.
Brian Lehrer on WNYC, and as Bill Moyers gets ready to turn 80 in a few weeks, if I've got his birthday right, he is still on public television by popular demand. Flirtations with retirement have just left too big a void in our national dialogue for too many viewers, so his weekly Moyers and Company is still on. We will look back, sideways, and forward in time now with Bill Moyers, who was also chief domestic policy advisor to President Lyndon Johnson at the dawn of the Great Society programs, among other things. And Bill, it's always great to have you on the show. Welcome back to WNYC.
Thank you very much, Brian. It's a marvelous place to be at this time of day.
You know, you had a quote about not being able to stay retired in the Progressive magazine that caught my eye, and I said, I have to talk to Bill Moyers about this on the air. You said, I'm angry at what's happening to our country and angry at myself that I can't do more. I would be miserable if I couldn't bear witness. And it was that term, would be miserable if you couldn't bear witness, that jumped out at me. And I imagine you don't use that term loosely, because to bear witness is not just to watch something. It's to provide evidence that something is true. Is that how you see your work?
If something is real, yes, to try to see the realities that are emerging in America today, the growing inequality, the reunion of church and state, the bringing in from the margins the delusional attitudes of people who don't belong in the center of our discourse, and yet they are dominating it with their shrieks and their shouts and their venom, to see what's happening to a country with so much promise and so much wealth and so much, you know, so much history. It angers me. It makes me mad that I'm reaching the end of my life and I haven't done a better job of helping the people out there who would like to keep us on a sane course.
What are you most angry at? Can you pinpoint it?
I grew up believing that civilization was built around reciprocity, right? You know, I was the son of poor parents, poorest white folks in town, but I went to good public schools. I had good public parks. I drove on a good public highway to a good public college and university, and all of that was paid for by other people whom I didn't know, who were dead, who had invested in their taxes and their resources in building the commons in Texas. And I just don't see how you can have a great civilization without that ability to anticipate the future and support it for those who wouldn't have that, who wouldn't have such an opportunity. I see this growing inequality between rich and poor and white and black as a threat to our future. It's unjust. It's unfair. I believe in a fair society, and I see on every front so much happening that is narrowing America's common good and will eventually eliminate it, eviscerate it.
I watched your very moving essay on your show the other week about your father and how the only time you saw him cry was on the day that FDR died. And yet you said in that piece that your father remained dirt poor. The Great Society, the New Deal programs of FDR didn't seem to touch him and his own economic situation personally. So how do you understand your own father's reaction to and devotion to FDR if it didn't touch him personally?
Partly it was the fact that FDR inspired him through his radio conversations. Radio, as you know, Brian, so intimate. It's so personal that you can feel that. I feel often that Brian Lehrer is talking just to me and exclusive to me, and I feel a relationship with you even though I don't see you. My father was a dirt poor tenant farmer who lost his job, had to leave the land because of the Depression. And never really recovered. He was knocked down, but not out. He had jobs. The most lucrative job he had in his life was the last few years of his of his working life when he made $100 a week. But Franklin Roosevelt talked to him as if Franklin Roosevelt genuinely understood what it was like to be poor. He didn't. He was an aristocrat, grew up in the lush hills and rivers of the Hudson Valley. But in a way that he expressed hope and understanding of people like my father. My father felt he was part of Franklin Roosevelt's extended family, although it was an aristocratic family in New York. This tenant farmer in Oklahoma and Texas felt a connection.
You worked in the Kennedy and Johnson administrations very much on the War on Poverty initiatives with LBJ. And even for LBJ, when he was a senator from Texas, and I guess like FDR, he was another one who came from an unlikely place to wind up politically where he did. Did you see him evolve in his views on poverty and economic justice from the time you went to work for him as a senator in the late 50s through when he was president with the Great Society programs?
I saw his, yes, I did. It wasn't so much that his views evolved, it is that he was able, when he became president in particular, to articulate, to express, to try to fulfill what he had seen as a poor boy himself when his father lost his position in Texas prior to the Depression, and when he was teaching young Mexican kids in Cotulla, Texas, as a teacher right out of college, or actually while he was in college. He knew, he understood, he appreciated, he had experienced what the realities of life for these kids, and he was able to move in that direction, to express them, to thrive on them, to let them drive him when he became president. He was once asked at a press conference, "Mr. President, you were not very enthusiastic about civil rights. You don't have a very great civil rights record in the Senate from Texas, and yet here you are pushing the civil rights bill 50 years ago, the voting rights bill 49 years ago. What's happened?" And there was a pause, and I held my breath. I wasn't sure how he was going to answer. And Johnson said, President Johnson said, "You know, Jim Deacon was the reporter for the St. Louis Post-Dispatch. A lot of us make mistakes when we're young, and few of us have a chance to correct them. I did, and I do, and that's what I'm going to do." And so that was his motive. Now, I also know that we made a lot of mistakes, and that, you know, there are people who say, well, if it weren't for Vietnam, Lyndon Johnson would be a great president. But you cannot separate Vietnam from Lyndon Johnson. The president can only be judged by the impact of his policies, by the consequences of the decisions he makes. And the consequences on the domestic side were generally good. The consequences on the foreign policy side, Vietnam, generally terrible. Bill, and so you have to judge him with that kind of perspective.
Bill Moyers with us on WNYC. And how about judging the Great Society programs? Because there is so much talk today, kind of celebrating the 50-year anniversaries of the great civil rights pieces of legislation and landmarks and some of the Great Society bills. And yet many people look at the state of poverty and inequality, and here you are 50 years later railing against the inequality in our country. And some people conclude we fought the war on poverty, as Johnson termed it, and poverty won. Did any Great Society programs make a lasting difference?
Head Start did, absolutely. Medicare did. There were other programs designed to help the poor that did work. Some did not work. The Community Action Program not only fell apart, but it was torn apart by politicians who did not want poor people at the local level having any means to contest their political power. So it's a mixed bag, but on the whole, poverty did diminish in the few years after the Johnson administration and then fell again. But you have to remember that having acknowledged the flaws and failures of our programs, I can say that for the last 40 years, you've had practically an all-out war on the poverty war, that you've had the other side, the conservative, beginning with Ronald Reagan and moved on by other Republicans through the other, as the Republican Party, once a moderate party, became a party of hardliners. They have been opposing the efforts to help the poor and the needy consistently, and that's been a factor. But some of the programs were just like a bad bridge that was architecturally poorly designed, just didn't work. Had it not been for the war, I think we would have had another 4 years to try to correct those in midstream.
And I wonder if you think something could have been done differently politically to have more of a lasting positive image to more Americans of the War on Poverty, Great Society programs, unless you think the Vietnam War just derailed it to too big a level even for that. But, you know, then came two terms of Nixon, and after Carter, the even bigger right-wing backlash under Reagan with his slogan, "Get Government Off My Back," which was really aimed at those programs by and large.
Richard Nixon deserves some credit for carrying forward some of the better aspects of the War on Poverty, including the Earned Income Tax Credit, which provides a base for certain working people. And, of course, on the environmental front, Nixon did some very good things. This is the truth of our political system, is that some guys can make some very serious mistakes and some very serious contributions. But it was really when the conservative came to power in 1980, and they really brought the free market ideology as gospel. They really do not believe that poor people should be helped in any way that undermines their own responsibility. That means they're forgetting the effects of the 250 years of slavery, Jim Crow, all of that. So, there were political things we could have done, absolutely, including sort of deracialize the War on Poverty. It appeared to people, and quite frankly, it was designed to help. It was a form of reparations for blacks because they had been so edged out of the system for so long. But had we deracialized the War on Poverty more effectively, more quickly, I think we would have had more poor whites. Now, you can say that in West Virginia, that's what we did. In West Virginia, it didn't get better over the years. I mean, democracy is a constant trial and error. It's an experiment. One president starts this, and the other president either builds on it, or the other president and his administration undermines it. It's a constant back and forth, and no policy is ever perfect, and no proposal is ever complete.
I want to get your take on one policy relevant to today that has nothing to do with directly with what we're talking about, that's really a media issue, but you did your last show on it, and that is net neutrality, which is a term that either sparks rage among people who are clued into its erosion, or it makes people's eyes glaze over because it sounds like some techno-wonky thing that's remote to their lives. Today, there happens to be a pro-net neutrality day of action being called Occupy the FCC. Do you care about this?
Very much so, and I've done a number of shows on it. I don't understand the technical issues that much, but I think of the web, the Internet, as our agora. I think of it as our Boston Commons. I think of it as our Hyde Park, and I know those are inadequate metaphors, but they suggest that we have something here quite unique to democracy, and that the more equal we can make access and utilization of it, the better off we'll be in the long run. That if it goes the way of radio, which was created and invented and presented as a great public utility, and then, of course, was taken over by corporate and commercial interests. Our television, which started out as a great force for education. Do you ever hear the term educational television anymore? Taken over by the market, by commercial interests. If the Internet is ultimately goes that way and is determined by who can afford the fast lane versus the slow lane, who can afford more time, who can afford more power, who can afford more access, we will lose the last great hope, I think, of the last 250 years to develop a Boston Commons for the nation, an Agora for the nation, a Hyde Park for the nation.
And I look at it this way. If corporations can buy their way onto an Internet fast lane into our homes and our phones compared to websites and such without as deep pockets, then what are the implications for news and democracy? Because deep-pocketed corporate news will be easier to access than, say, most independent public media. The equal access to journalism on the medium where most people get their news these days, the web, is at stake, and therefore the quality of democracy is at stake.
All I can say to that sermon is amen.
So, as a last thought, you own your own production company, and you have for a long time. You're not even dependent on PBS, if I'm correct, for your funding. Does that matter to how your content comes out?
Judith and I, my wife and I, are the partners in Public Affairs Television. We raise every penny of every production, and we make the decisions with our very talented young staff of what we're going to do. Yes, I was 5-7 years at CBS, and while I at CBS News and had a great run there, but I always had to present my ideas to a vice president who presented them to a president who presented them on up the ladder, and that was frustrating. I couldn't do the work that I really felt intuitively that I wanted to do. So we set up our own production company, and we've been able to do some, like the Great Society, some good things and some things that didn't work. But it's been our own call, our own decision. I am dependent still on PBS, public television, for the dissemination of my programs, because what I do, as what you do, would not make it commercially on corporate networks. So I depend upon public television, as you depend on public television stations. Now, that will change for you and me as the Internet develops and we can go directly to our constituencies. So it's an exciting time, but Judith and I have had a great run of it as independent producers, and I wouldn't have had it any other way.
Anything you want to plug coming up?
Yes, public radio. I mean, I'm in constant tension between coming to you for information and going to WQXR for inspiration. And I sometimes knock the radio off my shaving table or off my desk because I'm trying to change it to get to something that I like on both sides. And you are, in a larger way than our little operation on television, you are the Commons, the Agora, the Hyde Park, and you have this personal connection. I used to resent, Brian, what we're doing now, pledging for money for public television and public radio. I now know it's our connection to our voters. And I feel that building this subscriber membership base of support is our ultimate guarantee against the commercial corporate forces that are swallowing up, gobbling up, consuming everything in media today. So to your listeners, I have to say, respond to Brian's open net, his net neutrality, where everybody's welcome and all subjects can be discussed, by pledging right now. Don't wait.
Thank you. That was not a setup, by the way. I thought he was going to plug his next show, so I'll do that. Watch Bill Moyers every week on PBS. Thank you for giving us some time, Bill.
Thanks, Brian. Good luck to you.
Brian Lehrer on WNYC. Stay with us.